Good morning. My name is Beth Cole. I'm a senior program officer with our Center for Peace and Stability Operations at the U.S. Institute of Peace. I used to coordinate our Afghanistan working group. I've handed that privilege off to Alex Speer. Unfortunately, all of our staff at the moment that are working on Afghanistan are in Kabul, launching a dedicated USIP effort to expand our programming in Afghanistan. I'd like to welcome His Excellency Anwar al-Haq al-Hadi, the Minister of Finance to Afghanistan. He's been the minister since 2004. His Excellency came to this post with a unique background that actually included a background in political science as well as banking. So he's uniquely suited to take up this particular post in Afghanistan. Minister and his wife, actually, he doesn't know this, but they've also been active in some other very important Afghan initiatives. One of those is the initiative to educate Afghan women. And because of that, one of our staff members, Sonia Akbal, is here working on our Afghan programs. This initiative helps women and others to come to the United States. She spent 4 years getting her degree, and now she's doing her practical training at USIP. So we have another connection, and we're very thankful to you and your wife. I also want to acknowledge that the Ambassador Jawad is here from the embassy, hopefully he'll come back and join us after some very important new initiatives are released on Afghanistan in this country. But we have a very short amount of time. Minister has to leave at 12:30, so I'm just going to quickly turn this over to him, and he can share his thoughts with us, and then we'll take some questions from the audience. When we do that, I'd like to ask you to go up to the microphone and to introduce yourself and to make sure that you ask a question, since we have a limited amount of time. So, Minister, the floor is yours.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me here. It is indeed an honor to be here and to address you on an issue pertaining to Afghanistan. I'm sure you are all aware that there has been major changes in Afghanistan since the Karzai administration. I mean, there has been fundamental changes in the politics of the country, fundamental changes in the society, and fundamental changes in the economy or the economic system. I'm sorry to say that I'm a little bit bookish in the sense that I was given the title was Challenges to Growth, so I'm not going to talk about more political issues or social issues, and I'll just focus on the economic issues and particularly our challenges to growth. There are a number of factors that affect growth, and I think probably the most important factor that affects growth is the system, the economic system. There has been countries that have had lots of resources, very richly endowed with natural resources, and yet they have remained poor. And there has been countries that do not have that many resources, but they have become very prosperous. And the main reason for the change is that the economic system. And I think over the centuries, even though alternative economic systems have been argued about, I mean, we have had since the 19th century this great debate about socialism, right? And for a long time it was argued that socialism is more efficient, it is not only just more just, but also it's more efficient. And we did experiment with that. We have experimented with other models of state-controlled economies, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that maybe there is not the consensus, but the overwhelming majority of academicians would view that economic growth needs proper incentives, and the market-based economy provides the best incentive for sustainable economic growth. Well, just so happens that in Afghanistan, for the past few years, we have been trying to establish a market-based economy. And I will elaborate a little bit on the comparison between the two, as to what is the difference between the old system and the new system. in the old system, in the where the state controls the economy, production is partly done by the state and partly done by the private sector. And even in that area where production is done by the private sector is pretty much at the mercy of the state. The state can nationalize any sector. The state can confiscate through licensing. The state can accelerate, decelerate, etc., etc. And that was very much the case in Afghanistan, not only during the 1980s, which was pretty much, we call it the communist era or socialist era, but even before that, state had very strong control over the economy in the 1970s and in the 1960s. So banks were totally controlled by the state, insurance companies controlled by the state, civil aviation totally controlled by the state, utilities, trade, even though in trading the private sector was involved, the private sector could export, but whatever the private sector earned, the foreign exchange had to go to the central bank, and they would get in return the local currency. Well, that was the old system. In the new system, the emphasis is that the state should not be so much in the production of goods. The state should be more as a regulator. And we're not inventing the system. This is a system that has pretty much been it's pretty much the norm throughout the world. I mean, if you look at the U.S., if you look at Japan, European countries, they've all maybe in the past had, to some extent, the shared responsibility of the state being involved in production, but gradually they're moving out of that, and that is the idea behind the privatization of a lot of state-owned enterprises. So in the new economic system, we're emphasizing the separation between the public sector and between the private sector, and the public sector should be responsible for regulation, and the private sector should be responsible for production of goods and provision of services. In the market economy, it is the individual entrepreneur. It's the freedom of the individual to initiate economic activity that is more important. In the old system, it's the state that usually did the thinking, planning, and initiating economic activities. In the new system, the emphasis is more on the individual entrepreneur. Now, every individual entrepreneur, if he or she makes a good judgment, he or she would be handsomely rewarded by the market. But if he or she makes wrong judgment, then the market will punish the person. The good thing for the government is that if the individual makes the wrong decision, this is not a crisis, a fiscal crisis for the state. While when the state controls the economy, any downturn in any sector creates problems for the state. We're also of the belief that in the private sector is more efficient in the allocations of resources and production of goods, and because of increase in efficiency, you can increase the welfare of the society in general. What does the public sector do besides regulation? Well, it provides for law and order. This minimum level of security is absolutely necessary for economic transaction. Enforcement of contracts, that is the law and order part that is necessary for the operation of the private sector. You need infrastructure. These are mostly what's called public goods that will not be provided by the private sector, although the experiences of some more developed countries recently have indicated that even some of the goods that traditionally have been considered as public goods can pretty much be even privatized, and maybe such as roads can be. I mean, a private company can build it and they can charge tolls, etc. But the infrastructure, power, provision of power, telecommunication, water, urban development, roads, and one thing that's very important is the monetary stability. That is the responsibility of public sector. And of course, public sector taxes the private sector so it can pay for the private goods. Now, as I said, in Afghanistan, we have pretty much adopted this new model of separation between the private sector and between the public sector. And we have, consequently, we have allowed for the autonomy of the central bank. So the central bank can provide for a more stable monetary environment. And that is the norm throughout the world. secret, and the government should not tell the central bank how to fight inflation, what interest rates to charge, and how much money supply should be. And you know, these are usually the variables that are relevant for monetary stability. And we have adopted a new law which allows the central bank to decide on these more on professional basis and not on political political consideration. We have started privatization of our state-owned enterprises. There are about 65 of them, and we have done thus far maybe two or three, but we intend to finish privatization of state-owned enterprises maybe in the next 3 years. We have liberalized our investment law. In the past, there were lots of constraints on investment. Foreigners, for instance, they were restricted as to what they could own and how much, what percentage they could earn. What percentage they could own. Now, foreigners can have 100% of any enterprises that they would like to. As a matter of fact, it's so liberal that we don't make any differentiation between Afghan entrepreneurs and foreign entrepreneurs, and they will have exactly the same privileges as Afghans will have. And this very systematically and logically, it's derived from the general philosophy of market-based economy. We have liberalized our trade. The traders, they decide what to import, how much to import, and what price to charge. Without really taking any permission from the government, and we do not interfere with their foreign exchange. If they want to deposit that with us in Afghanistan, they are free. If they don't want to deposit with us, they can deposit wherever they want. We do not have any restriction on how much of their profits they can send abroad and how much they can invest. It's totally up to them to decide on this. And again, this is very much based on the philosophy of market-based economy. We have liberalized our foreign exchange system. In the past, as I mentioned earlier, if you had foreign exchange, you had to give that to the central bank, and you would have to get then you would get local currency. Now it's totally up to the individuals and the companies. It's whether they want to send their money into Afghanistan or out of Afghanistan. And sometimes this is heavily criticized, especially the old paradigm. People who were used to the old paradigm, they were constantly criticizing the central bank and the Ministry of Finance for allowing foreign exchange to leave Afghanistan. But of course, that is very much in line with the rest of our philosophy, and that is individual freedom there. And we think that in the long run, it is helpful for us. As a matter of fact, a good test of that is that people, they decide themselves to bring in money, and they decide themselves to leave, to take money out of the country. When I started it, I think at the central bank, I think in terms of our reserves were very low. We had some gold, and we had $175 million in dollars. Now our reserves are more than $2 billion. And even though a lot of money is leaving Afghanistan, but then a lot of money is coming also into Afghanistan, and that follows the system. Well, I visited somewhere, and I'd forgotten to take that out. The banking system, which used to be completely controlled by the government. We had six government-owned banks. We liquidated four of them. Now we have only two state-owned banks. But we have about 15 privately owned banks, and they do most of the banking. As a matter of fact, two of our privately owned banks are expanding very rapidly, that we were a little bit concerned, and we asked the central bank to really monitor this, the expansion of those two banks. Our telecommunication industry has become almost totally private. We used to have, the government used to be totally responsible for telecommunication. We allowed private investors to get involved here. In the past 4 years, they have invested about $800 million in the telecommunication sector. And now subscribers to the mobile telephones are about more than 3 million people, and this is totally private. There is civil aviation, a number of companies that have started it, civil aviation. I hope they would merge. Probably there are too many for a small market like Afghanistan, and I hope that there will be some mergers so that we get the larger companies there. But it's up to them. They'll have to decide there. So, as I started it, one factor that affects economic growth is system. And as I said, the system is throughout the world. We believe that market-based economies provide better incentive and better system for growth, and we have laid the foundation, we have built the superstructure, but we need to strengthen the superstructure of this new economic system. We have the laws for this new system. We don't have all the bylaws and all the regulations that are needed for the system to work, but we will be working on this to strengthen this. Now, what are some of the positive results as far as growth is concerned? Well, growth has been high, not totally because of our market economy, both because of our increased public expenditure and because of the private sector growth. But growth has been very high in the past few years. In the past 5 years, we have doubled our GNP. Per capita income has been doubled. This year, we are expecting about 13% in growth. That is pretty high. Okay. And at the same time, because we have allowed the central bank to be independent and to watch inflation, inflation has been relatively low. I mean, last year it was less than 5%. This year we're expecting it to be about 8%. And the main reason for this year's increase in inflation is because fuel prices, which we import total amount that we need, we import from outside, and we have no control over that. And also, we are not self-sufficient in food. We import our food, part of it, and that is worldwide. There's been an increase in prices for foodstuff, so that's why there has been a little bit higher inflation. But still, for an economy that is growing at 13%, 8% inflation is really not that high. It's pretty good. I think the new system also has benefited the people in the sense that services are better now. Services that are provided by the private sector are much better. In the past, you know, the socialist countries, but also not just socialist countries, but state-controlled economies, you had to wait for years in order to get a telephone line. You had to get for years, and you had the money, but you couldn't buy a car. Okay, and you had to get permission in order just to get outside of to leave your country. Well, now, individuals, Afghans, 3 million people own their own telephone. And they manage it. The state has got nothing to do with it. We are lucky. I mean, we are fortunate in the sense that we get almost $40 million in annually from taxes, from sales tax on the operation of these telephones. So in the same way that they would go to a shop to buy whatever they want to buy, now they, if they want to have a telephone, it is another problem. Well, in the past, you had to use very high-level connection in the government in order to be able to get one line of telephone. So there are better services. The same goes for banking. They can get their money anytime, at ease. I mean, of course, they have to pay the price for that. And the same goes for civil aviation. There are so many companies, and they can compare the prices, and whenever they want to go, it's much easier for them to use that. But there has been some problems, too, with the new system, and that is higher prices. In a more socialist system, the government controls prices. Now we don't control prices, and very often we get very high prices, and the general public complains. And I think to some extent, some of this is, if it is genuinely market operation, then we cannot do anything about it, in the sense that when the price of fuel increases worldwide, there is nothing that the government can do about it. The only thing that the government, if it had the resources, could subsidize it. But we don't recommend that, nor do we have the resources that even if we made such recommendation, we could not really implement it because we don't have such resources to subsidize that. But sometimes there is, because the system is new, because we have not developed all the bylaws, the competition is not that high. And sometimes providers in the private sector, they take advantages of the lack of development of adequate development of laws. There is also, in the part of some people, there is resistance to change. I mean, these people, they were used to the state-controlled economy. Now that we are privatizing, some people benefit, but some people are affected negatively by this. Yeah, and they do resist. Initially, when we started it, when we say, okay, we're going to privatize, they did not understand the meaning. Now that we go into the implementation phase, the small number of people that are affected, they are resisting this. And because we, at the same time, we have a democracy, they go to parliament, they go to the media, etc., etc., and they pursue their interest in such a way that, in my opinion, is not very fair to the government. There's also greater uncertainty in the market system. I mean, that is the very definition of market. I mean, ups and downs. I mean, we were earlier talking about the real estate market. You know, when the prices go up and you are in that business, you're very happy about it. But when prices go down, well, you are very unhappy about it. And I mean, in Afghanistan, it's the same thing. I mean, you benefit in some ways, but you also get hurt in some ways, and so that creates a little bit of a problem there. Also, the main reason why people wanted to go into socialism was this concern with equality. The market-based system creates inequality. And some people make a lot of money, other people do not. In more advanced countries, they manage that. I mean, to some extent in the United States, but mostly in the social democratic countries in Western Europe, they specify a minimum standard of living that everyone should benefit from, a minimum standard of living. Beyond that, you'll have a progressive taxation. You can be a millionaire, but you'll have to pay higher taxes. Okay. Well, in case of Afghanistan, it's such a poverty-stricken country, we cannot provide for a minimum standard of living. So some people, they have acquired a lot of wealth, and others do not. And human beings, it's not just the absolute level of welfare that they have, but they also compare themselves with others. It's a question of relative. Where do we stand in society? And that has a negative impact on some people. And again, in a more market-based economy, there is greater accumulation of wealth, and just a few people that they get a lot more than the rest of society, and that sometimes, of course, that will happen in Afghanistan, and sometimes it can be exploited for political purposes. There's also greater inequality right now in salaries. Government salaries are very low, private sector salaries are higher, and it creates a problem. But none of these problems are unexpected. I mean, this is normal in other market economies, and this will happen in Afghanistan, and it has happened in Afghanistan. There are, however, a number of unexpected problems in Afghanistan. One thing, why do we go to market? Because we want to have better quality goods and services at lower prices. How do we possibly get there? Through competition. Well, unfortunately, even though we have allowed for competition, sometimes we don't get enough competition. So we have in a certain, only we have large contracts, and only one or two companies, they qualify to apply for that contract. This is a serious problem. I've discussed it with the World Bank, since we are receiving their funds and we have to do procurement in accordance with their regulations, that sometimes I don't think we get good value for the contracts that we sign. And that is, I think, we are lacking in terms of some additional laws. And I think we should be constantly monitoring this so that we get the best value. And there has been a lot of criticism directed at the international community as well as the government that billions of dollars have been spent in Afghanistan, but the impact has not been as large. And I think probably there is some truth to it that those people who say that there has not been a significant amount of change in Afghanistan, I think they are totally wrong. But they could argue that the change could have been much greater than what we have achieved, and I think probably there is some truth to that argument. There is some protest against the market system, but what is required for us, I think, is perseverance. I think that the system is right. I don't think that all these countries can be wrong and that we will come up with a system that will be better than that of the U.S., than that of the European countries or Japan or the rest of the world. We have to persevere in this regard, and I hope that very often we get negative commentaries from intellectuals, and I think that they not only they should be more cautious in criticizing the system and in criticizing the government in this regard. But I think that it would be fair to the government, and I would be also fair to the society and to themselves, that they really understand, because very often I think we get criticism that is not well informed. I mean, I'll be willing to debate with anyone, and I'll be first to concede it was are the problems. But if they think that they can show me a better system than this, I seriously doubt it, and I'll be very happy to debate this with them. And very often, unfortunately, their criticism is not well informed. Their criticism does not have the intellectual depth that they should have. In criticizing something, and unfortunately, when you don't have that, to me, to some extent, this is irresponsible. When you really don't know your subject matter and you are making recommendations for substantial changes, that is irresponsible, because maybe the general public will follow and they will think that, well, I think I can combine the good things from this system with the good things from that system. Well, it's not possible. In philosophy, you cannot, I mean, if you opt for eclecticism in philosophy, you are not a philosopher. You will end up in contradictions. If you think that you will benefit from the freedom of the market system, but at the same time you impose price controls, you cannot do it. They have tried it. In the U.S., they tried it for a limited period of time during the Nixon administration. It didn't work. In other countries, it has not. So what we do is, within the system, within the logic of the system, we have to come up as to how we can improve the situation. The second factor that's affecting growth is resources. And unfortunately, Afghanistan is not very rich. I mean, it's rich in terms of natural resources, but those resources will have to be developed. It will require billions of dollars in investment. But right now, we don't have that many resources. When we started the Karzai administration, our first year annual revenue for the government was $118 million. Now, this year, we're hoping to collect $715 million. But our recurrent expenditure alone this year is about $1,100 million. Okay. So we're left with nothing to invest in infrastructure. Our $350 million for our recurrent budget, that is paid by the international community. And our development budget is entirely financed by the international community. So we don't have really that much resources. In terms of per capita income, we are one of the lowest. We have rich mineral resources, I say, but they need to be exploited. And when we made an estimate of how much do we need to reconstruct Afghanistan for the reconstruction of Afghanistan, the minimum that was required was $30 billion. But of course, we cannot raise that sort of funds from the private market, from the international market, not from international institutions. And certainly our savings, even though we have some rich merchants, but the total amount of their savings is probably not more than $3 or $4 billion. So that's not going to really help us. So what we need is, for purpose of development in Afghanistan, we need international assistance. And we need international FDI, foreign direct investment in Afghanistan. Amount of assistance that has been provided to us has been pretty good. We are fortunate. The international community has been generous with us, excluding the recent supplemental requests. The request that has been made by the U.S. government in the supplementary budget, total pledges made to Afghanistan in the past 5 years has been $30 billion. Of that, about $16 billion have been committed. And of this, over $13 billion have been spent. Okay. But our needs are much larger than this. We're just doing our national development strategy. And we haven't yet started implementing our national development strategy. And our estimate is that for the next 5 years, we will need between $30 to $35 billion. With the amount of resources that we have received in foreign assistance, we have been able to provide the basic transportation, the road, the ring road. Now, the Afghans' transportation facilities are much better now than they used to be. Okay. But this is very, very basic. And we're working now on the power. And probably within a year, we might be able to have the minimum that is required for Afghanistan in terms of power. We have spent a lot of money on education. During the Taliban, I think we have something like 800,000 to 900,000 students in schools. Now we have over 6 million students in schools, and 35% of them are women. 82% of people now benefit from what's called basic health package that the government has introduced. This is not health insurance. This is very basic stuff that they have. Rebuilding state institutions, we have made significant progress. We do have an army now. We do have police. I think the basis of the administration is there. Whether our foreign presence, it needs a lot more to be improved, but we have the amount of resources we have received, we have spent well there. But still, overall, we don't have enough resources, and without resources, that is a major constraint to growth. And one reason why we have had high growth in the past few years is because of foreign assistance, but foreign assistance cannot go forever. So, but for a number of years to come, without foreign assistance, we will not be able to have sustainable growth. FDI, foreign direct investment, is very important. As I mentioned here, in the field of telecommunication, the investment has been mostly foreign, and it has been good. I think we're about to have a major investment in mining, in the copper, exploitation of copper or extraction of copper from the copper mine there. But they have not invested that much in manufacturing. And we really need to get into manufacturing, because our balance of trade is terrible. I mean, we import about $4 to $5 billion worth of goods, and we export less than $500 million. And we need to get involved in manufacturing. ODA, official development assistance, needed for building adequate infrastructure, state building, and education in the future. The foreign assistance we have received, a lot of that foreign assistance will be spent in the future on security, and I think that not enough on economic development, and we need both. Security, without security, nothing else matters. I mean, in the sense that education, health, economic development will only make sense if you had adequate security. But there is a linkage, or there is an interactive relationship between economic development and between security. Well, a minimum level of security is necessary, is almost a precondition for economic activity or for economic development. Once that minimum level of security is provided, then greater economic activity promotes stability, and greater stability then adds to economic activity. So I would like to draw the attention of donors to the importance of economic activity, that while we are very thankful for the amount of resources we have been receiving, we do need a bit larger proportion of resources to be allocated to economic activities. In terms of resources management, I think there should be a stronger government ownership. The foreign aid that we receive, very often in the decision making how it should be used, the government ownership is not as much or as strong as it should be. And as I said, in the past, maybe since it was a failed state, the bureaucracy wasn't adequate there, perhaps it made sense that donors directly, they allocated resources as they wanted it to. But now, starting next fiscal year, which starts in March, we'll have a national development strategy, and allocation of resources in the budget will have to be in accordance with our national development strategy, and it is imperative that our donors work with us and coordinate allocations of resources in accordance with the priorities that we have in our national development strategy. Third factor that's affecting growth is the issue of management. And in this area, again, it's a very, very, we're in a very poor situation. The 20 or 25 years of fighting not only destroyed the country, it destroyed our educational institutions. I mean, there were universities in name. People graduated from medical schools, but they were not doctors. People graduated from engineering, but they could not do any engineering. And people graduated from business schools, but they did not know the ABC of accounting or economics, for that matter. Consequently, most of people who have graduated from universities, it is very difficult for us to use them in areas which require really professional training. Professionals in Afghanistan are very expensive now. I mean, if you could find someone who has graduated, who has studied accounting, you'll be lucky if you find someone for fresh graduates in accounting for $2,000. Well, the same person in Pakistan may not make more than $200 or $300 per month. And that's one area that unfortunately is going to be a long-term problem for us, because even if our educational institutions were to be reformed right now, it will take at least 4 or 5 years before we can see the product of this reform. And reforms is also becoming more difficult. There are vested interests in all institutions, and of course in every reform some people benefit and others lose. And those who have dominant position in the existing situation, they would not want those changes to happen. So I don't think that it would be as smooth as we would like it to be. But even if it were very smooth, and if we did not have any political obstacles in implementing reform, still it would be another 5 years before we could have really qualified people. And then if we need people at a higher level, a master degree and PhD, and that would take even longer. And generally, even those people who have master degrees and PhD, they need additional training and they need experiences before we could really give them a managerial position. But in Afghanistan, people who have had basic good education, they have been promoted very rapidly in the past few years. I mean, I can tell you from my Ministry of Finance, I first went there. I hired somebody who was 27 years old to be the general treasurer of the country, managing about 2 billion to 2.5 billion. He had 1.5 year experience, but he had an MBA, and to me, he was a trainable person. Well, I did well with him. I hired someone like 28 years old to be the director of revenues. Again, an MBA, studied in Pakistan with 2-3 years of experiences, and I gave him the general position. The same goes for the customs. As a matter of fact, the old guard, who did not like this, at one time they started the campaign that Ahadi is building a kindergarten at the Ministry of Finance. Because all the directors and my deputy ministers, they were young, but they were well-educated. Now, these people, whom I give very, very important positions, they could never even dream of getting such position in a country like in Sri Lanka, in Bangladesh, in Pakistan, in Iran, in Turkey, in these countries. And the reason why they got such is because we don't have anyone. So they were very lucky. But this problem is going to stay with us for some time to come, and I think this is going to be a major constraint on growth, because our skilled managers that are going to be very expensive, and we have to compete with the others. So while other places, they are not going to be that expensive. One other factor recommendation on this area, I think the emphasis should be on education, especially higher education. I've told the Minister of Higher Education repeatedly that if he came up with a good strategy for the future of higher education, I'll be willing to give him double and triple the amount of money that he has been receiving in the past. And I think he's doing okay, but I don't think he has given me a strategy that I had in mind. So we'll see what happens there. Okay. Security is unfortunately becoming a hindrance to development. Until a year and a half ago, I don't think security was a problem at all. I think the recent security issue has hurt us in some ways, because now the cost of development project is very high. There's almost 25% to 30% increase in the price of development project just to take care of the security situation. And we hope that that will be addressed. And I think in the long run, I'm pretty confident that the government will be able to handle this. But in the short term, this is going to be a negative factor for us, and we have to live with that. Corruption is another problem that hinders growth. And that's because it makes the cost of transactions much higher. I mean, if you have a contract and it costs you $1 million, you may as well, when there is in a society there is corruption, you'll have to assume that it's going to be not $1 million, it's going to be more than that. Okay. It's a serious problem. The government is very much aware of this, and we would like, probably there's no one more willing to solve or to get rid of this problem than President Karzai is, myself and the other members of the government are. I asked about a year and a half ago the World Bank to study the modalities of corruption, the causes of corruption, and most importantly, how we can fight corruption. They give us recommendations. They have not completed their studies. They have half of the studies they have given us. That deals with public money, the management of public finance. We have implemented all those recommendations, and I'm very confident that our public finance is transparent. I know of no instance in which there's been embezzlement or any other type of mismanagement of public finance, and I have challenged people. If they have anything, please let me know. We will follow that. So as far as the Treasury operation is concerned, the budget is concerned, I'm very confident there. But there is this service delivery that does not go through the budget. And there is corruption there, and we expect or we are awaiting a recommendation as to how we fight those things. Well, we don't have much time. Well, I'll conclude. I think economically we have done well. I think there are some setbacks are normal, and I think we will eventually overcome those setbacks. I think we have identified problems. We do need international support, both in the security area as well as in the economic area. And overall, I'm pretty confident that eventually we will overcome these problems, and we will do well, because I don't know of any other alternative, of any better alternative to this. And if you compare us with other countries, with all the problems, probably we will compare not too poorly. I think with the continued support of the international community, our ultimate objective is to build a democratic polity, a pluralist society, and a market-based economy that will lead to prosperity. I think with the support of the international community, eventually we will be able to achieve that. So I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, the minister warned me of his professorial bent. I feel like I've just been in a graduate seminar, except with in a real place. And clearly his return to Afghanistan is the U.S.'s loss, but Afghanistan's gain. So thank you so much for helping us understand the current challenges there. I'm opening the floor. If you could please identify yourself and actually go to the microphone.
Hi, my name's J.J. Smith. I'm a writer with the Society for Human Resource Management. I focus on global HR. You mentioned the labor situation. Are professionals returning to Afghanistan, accountants, engineers, technicians needed to run manufacturing? I understand at one time there was a plan to appeal to patriotism to get professionals to return. You mentioned it's not very well, but are they returning?
Yes, some of them are returning, not enough to run the economy. But there is a problem even with those who are returning, Afghans who are returning to Afghanistan. They have lived in the West. They have families in the West. And they cannot live with the kind of salary that is that Afghanistan can afford. If they come back to Afghanistan and if they seek the kind of salary that they are making here or close to it, that is unsustainable. All our aid will be spent on supporting salaries that high. Well, the reason I'm saying is that we have to have professionals that are graduates of our own institutions is because they should not cost us that much. Given Afghanistan's economy, I mean, an accountant should not cost me more than $300 to $400 there. But if I bring an accountant from the, and I have, I don't have a general, I don't, at the Ministry of Finance, I don't have an auditor. I hired an Afghan from the U.S. And we managed to find a salary of $5,000 for him. He's an MBA. Well, it's not enough for him. And I do understand, his family is here. But paying $5,000 salary for an accountant in Afghanistan, it's not sustainable. Nobody in India will pay such salary. Nobody in Iran would pay such salary. So it's not really a doable proposition. I mean, I love their patriotism, I mean, I appreciate that. But I don't know as to how realistic that is. I mean, maybe a few people can sacrifice all this. But I can't expect thousands of people to come back and accept Afghan salaries and be productive as they were in the West. But that's what we need, to have much higher productivity at regional salaries. For now, in the short term, we appreciate Afghans coming back there, and even though it's expensive, we will use grants, and we are using grants to support these people. But long term, those grants are not going to be available. And we shouldn't be using grants for such high salaries. In the short term, we don't have any option, so we welcome them and we appreciate them coming. But long term, we'll have to have a different solution, a more native local solution there, and that is to develop our... I'd rather spend a lot more money on Kabul University and some other universities to get better professors there, better facilities, and to graduate more qualified graduates so we can use them in the economy.
Next, please.
My name is Warnock Huntress from USAID, and I saw you speak last week regarding disbursement, your government's ability to disperse better than donors do. I'm wondering if you can comment on the strengths and weaknesses of your government's ability to do that on disbursement.
Okay. Can I just take the next question, too, so that we have...
Yeah. Sure. My name is Bill Putnam. I'm from the U.S. Army. A quick question I wanted to ask is, in relation, sir, what you're talking about security, and what you laid out a really great strategic plan at the national level, but, I mean, how is it you're going to be able to do these market reforms in the South and in the East, say, in Helmand Province and Musa Qala and other places where the government can't even go? And the fact is the Taliban has more control and freedom of movement in that area, and therefore villagers in those places will say Kabul isn't here, and they have to go with what's there. How are your reforms going to help change that? Okay. Thank you.
And let me just take the third question, and then we'll...
Okay.
Wrap it.
Hossein Ibn Yusuf, International Petroleum Enterprises. You mentioned the total dependency of Afghanistan on imported fuels. Since Afghanistan has some limited natural gas resources, and which are partially developed, I was wondering how much has been done and what are the plans for development of the natural gas resources?
Okay, on disbursement, I mean, usually the question is that, if we channel more resources through the Afghan government may not be able to spend that amount of money. It's been 3 years that I have asked the international community, give us a greater challenge and see whether we can deliver on that or not. Our current budget development, the government budget, is $2.6 to $2.7 billion, development budget and recurrent budget. We think we will be able to disperse about 60 to 65% of that amount. And the remaining is largely because we have to have very strict rule of procurement to enhance transparency. Some of the contracts might be completed sometimes towards the end of the year. But then those projects will be ready early next year to be implemented. I think we have a pretty good level of capacity to disperse funds. But even if we had low level of capacity to disperse funds, we could acquire that capacity with hiring more people and paying the kind of salaries that international organizations pay. I mean, probably even one half of the amount that they are paying, if we could pay that kind of salaries to people, we can enhance our capacity considerably. But let me now also give you some data that our implementation rate of the budget, developmental budget, is in terms of contract signed, about 70% of the budget. In terms of disbursement, about 60% of the budget. But the disbursement of international external budget, money that is spent outside of the government, you know, their disbursement rate is about 35%. They are much slower than we are. As a matter of fact, the World Bank has commented repeatedly that the government of Afghanistan, as far as implementation rate of the budget is concerned, is quite high. I mean, I can tell you, let's say the United States total pledges are $23 billion. Of $23 billion, only $8 billion have been committed. Of $8 billion, thus far, disbursement is only $5 billion. That is not as high as our implementation rate. And we can do this the same with others. Their procurement here, the European Commission's, sometimes it takes them 1 year to do procurement. Yeah, unfortunately, our procurement takes 3 to 4 months too. And that's why sometimes the money that's allocated to certain projects in that year are not spent. And that is largely for procurement. And why do we have to have procurement, such meticulous process of procurement? It's because of concerns with transparency. Speed and transparency, they are somewhat in conflict. If you go for very high speed, then you will lose in terms of transparency. And we would like to have, you know, a decent level of transparency with a decent level of speed. So I'm not buying really that argument. I think we will be able to manage, and I think it will be most efficient that the government is given more resources. But even if the government, I do understand that some of our donors, they have institutional restrictions on how much money they can channel through the national budget. All what we are asking for is really coordination. And thank God, I think we have reached some sort of understanding. I had recently, I mean, the other day, I had with the director of USAID, I had a discussion on this, and I think she very much agrees with us. And hopefully that we will be every year sitting down and discussing our priorities, budgetary priorities, the availability of resources, and then discussion of projects to be implemented. We hope that this less coordinated scenario that we have, that is pretty much a story of the past, and that we move into a more coordinated allocations of resources and implementation and disbursement. With regards to reform in Helmand, yes, in areas where security is not there, there isn't that much we can do. But Helmand is not the entire country, and we hope that it will be contained. still, even though in Helmand the situation is that way, but we're still collecting 30% more revenues than we did last year. But this is just, I want to reiterate that for us, security is priority number one. I mean, you can go back to the Leviathan, Hobbesian view that in the state of nature there is no civilization, there is no... the state of nature is the state of insecurity. That's what he called it, the state of nature, but it's basically where there is war, there is no security. There is no civilization, there is no education, there is no industry. Life is short, brutish, and I don't know what other adjective he used. That's the situation. And we would not, I mean, our first priority is to get out of that situation and then to address the issue of development. But as I said, after providing for a certain level of security, then economic development becomes important in contribution, in contributing to stability and peace. And that's why I think that we should keep into consideration that a sufficient amount of resources should be given to for purposes of economic development. Development of natural resources, oil and gas, I think the hydrocarbon law, we passed it last year. There were some problems that the World Bank thought that we had lost certain important concepts in the translation. We will be correcting the situation, and I think soon, within months, there will be, the exploration and exploitation of oil and gas fields will be awarded based on international bidding.
Okay. Well, we're right on time, and I appreciate all of your contributions here today, and I invite you to come back and join us again when you're in the United States.
Thank you.
And please join me in thanking the minister.
Thank you very much.